home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And I am Rob Watson. Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. We have another information-packed, emotionally packed, important concept-packed hour for you. This is one of those ones that you want to listen to. You want to share this with your friends. We're going to go into some pretty deep issues that nobody seems to be talking about, and that is mental health and the LGBT community. And it really begs the question, are we helping our most vulnerable? Tonight, we are focusing around a specific story to start, which is Scout Schultz, a leader of the LGBT student group at Georgia Tech Institute. And you may have heard this story. Scout was fatally shot by police when Scout turned on them with a knife and proceeded to move forward aggressively, refusing to drop the knife. We're going to hear from our panel of journalists on the specifics of that story, but we also want to look into the issue of mental health and figuring out, what the broader topic is. Tonight, we're going to be joined by some special guests. Ellen Kahn is Director of Children, Youth, and Family Program at the Human Rights Campaign, where she provided national leadership and expertise in public education and advocacy efforts on behalf of LGBT youth and families. Also joining us is Cheryl Cornfield, a clinical psychologist who's practicing in New York and Brooklyn. She graduated from Washington University, and she has much expertise through her own coming out experience that has allowed her to explore and understand the nuances and stressors that come with same-sex attraction and mental health. So a distinguished panel, and we are excited to have them. Also is our regular panel of Brody Levesque and Kim Atom, who are distinguished journalists in their own right, and we will be hearing with them. First of all, I want to bring on our guests, both Ellen and Cheryl. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. and I want to introduce Brody Levesque and Karen.
Good evening.
Welcome to the show.
Hey there.
Good evening.
Hey. Hey there. Okay, we've got the gangs all here. Brody, why don't you take us through Scout's story and kind of set up where we're going with this.
We had a situation that occurred at Georgia Tech earlier this month where a young non-binary member of the community had apparently called the campus police for Georgia Tech and had set up that there was an individual with long blonde hair and a white T-shirt and jeans, possibly intoxicated, holding a knife, possibly armed with a gun, near one of the dorms in the parking facilities at Georgia Tech. Responding officers encountered what was later determined to be a Scout. Scout kept telling them in his video of it to shoot me. Kept advancing on the officers. The officers kept backing up, and at some point, after ordering Scout numerous times to drop a weapon, opened fire. Upon further investigation by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation after the shooting, three suicide notes were found in Scout's dorm room. And then much later, Scout's family, through their attorney, Chris Stewart, said that Scout apparently had a history of mental illness and was apparently experiencing an episode or a complete breakdown. And, of course, the attorney also accused Georgia Tech's officers of overreacting and not handling the situation well. Ironically, Scout was also head of Georgia Tech's Pride Alliance group. There was some associated protests after the shooting, and then it later became violent. During the course of all of this, it was also talked about the fact that the signs had been there, discussions had occurred earlier, not necessarily with, obviously, university officials nor the university police department, but there were people that were, in fact, aware of this. And the number one question that was raised was whether or not appropriate measures or appropriate actions had been taken to do something to possibly even prevent this. And then after everything was more or less over and done with, and since that time, the question has been raised, what exactly is being done in a larger sense to help LGBTQI individuals, some of whom are suffering from mental health challenges and issues? And unfortunately, this week we've now seen it again, not once but twice, with a spike in calls to suicide hotlines as a result of the transgender young lady being killed in Missouri, and then the bully teenager in the Bronx who lost the plot and killed his people who were tormenting him. So this is the foundation for our conversations this evening, those three particular cases, and the overriding and overarching question, are we doing enough?
Ellen, can we go to you on that? What is your assessment from the HRC's perspective on what are we doing as a community, and what is your assessment of the situations that Brody just outlined?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of things that are much better for a young queer person who's 20 now than, you know, when many of us on the phone came out at that age 20, 30, 40 years ago. So I think, you know, overall, there's sort of a movement forward, but there are huge gaps in accessibility of, you know, LGBTQ competent mental health providers, school counselors, pediatricians, other professionals, and, you know, so many parents who don't even know how to talk to their kids, even if they're supportive parents and, you know, pretty open-minded about having a kid who's LGBTQ, just not understanding how to have conversations about what young people are experiencing, where their support's coming from, what's happening at school, do they have friends, how are they handling stress. And so, you know, I feel like there are, you know, certainly significant gaps in terms of just acknowledging that, you know, if you work in a school, you're a school counselor, you're a principal, you definitely have LGBTQ students in that school, whether you know it or not. So there are things you need to do. And I would, you know, say certainly colleges and universities across the country, even those that have, you know, LGBTQ centers and have out students and have a really generally good reputation, we don't really get to that granular level of, you know, are the folks who are providing campus-based health services or mental health services, especially to someone like Scout who came to college with some pre-existing mental health challenges. And I think, you know, whether you're LGBTQ or not, when you leave home and you go to college, you know, a lot of your safety net is left behind. And, you know, it's a very anxiety-producing time. So I feel like that's a time, particularly for LGBTQ and other sort of marginalized youth, where all of the faculty and staff and providers and support systems on these campuses need to be, you know, doubling down on making sure they're supporting kids. And I guess the final thing I'll say is, you know, the way the police, we don't know for sure whether the police officers had any perception of Scout's sexual orientation or gender identity. But what we do know from the videos is that they had no training in how to de-escalate someone who's in a mental health crisis. And that's another really big missing piece is campus police, regular, you know, beat patrol police, don't have training, don't really know how to recognize when someone is having mental health distress, and that is a very different approach than you would approach someone who's actually, you know, engaged in criminal behavior.
Wow, thank you. Cheryl, I want to go to you on what these kids are going through. A lot of times in today's world, we kind of assume that we have infrastructure that is more supportive than there was in the past, and that should just kind of solve everything. But yet we still have higher incidence of suicide, mental health issues, drug addiction, et cetera, within the LGBT community, particularly in the transgender and bisexual communities. What is going on there, and what is your assessment of what should and could be done for them, and what is in their head?
So I think from a, you know, mental health perspective, there's a lot obviously going on for these youth. There's a higher incidence of depression, anxiety, questioning just identity and life, and there's not, as it's been talked about, enough training for, you know, whether it's principals or even the teachers to find it and to identify these students and to talk to them. And I think there's, during transition periods for anybody is really difficult, and I'm talking about life transitions in general, whether it's going off to college or leaving high school, going to college, a loss of somebody in their life, or coming out or realizing that maybe they have a same-sex attraction and they feel so different from the people around them, or maybe it's that they're recognizing more and more that they don't identify with one gender, and there's resources out there, but it still doesn't feel like enough. So these transitions for anybody in life, if you think about going from, you know, leaving one job and going to another, that's hard enough for anybody. But this is really about identity and who they are and who's going to support them, and so many questions that they have and not enough support around them, and people that don't necessarily recognize that everybody needs support. So the anxiety, the depression, the loneliness factor, all of that goes up. And if the supports aren't in place, then that feeling of being alone will just manifest. And then, you know, over time, even if they're in therapy or even if they're seeing a psychologist, psychiatrist, they have support of their family, as it looks like Scout, you know, did, based on what I've been reading about this. And also it sounds like Scout was, I think, the president or the head of, you know, the LGBTQ club at the school. There's still not enough mental health resources out there for the youth out there and for anybody going through this, that they're just in a period of transition, in a period of questioning and not having enough talk about it. People aren't talking enough to make the stigma feel less and less there. And the shame that comes out of all of this, you know, is really what's, in a sense, killing them. There's just so much shame, and the weight, if you think about the weight on your shoulders, just growing and growing and growing, and really just not wanting to feel what you're feeling, in that sense, they feel like the only way out is to kill themselves or find a way out in that way, when really what they're trying just to do is end the feelings that are going on and not necessarily end their life. And if they found that there was a different out for them, you know, and they knew about it and they could talk about it and it was open enough that people could talk about and there was enough training that the campus police, a professor, anybody could just be there, then they might see that there's other ways out and other options. And I think that's
it's really intense. Karen, mm-hmm. you've covered the LGBTQ beat for quite a while, and obviously, sadly, many of these kind of stories have come out over the years, from Leila Acorn to, you know, different kids who have been in this situation. What is your observation over time of what has caused this, and from your perspective, what do you see going on in the community?
Well, I'd kind of like to answer that in two ways, one professionally and one personally. Professionally, over time, I think that the overall environment really matters a lot. When there is hope, when there is excitement, when it looks like we're on the brink of change and it's real and people are talking to each other. And by the way, I'm a, you know, leftover hippie. So, I mean, I'm talking about, for instance, what happened at Woodstock. I'm talking about what happened, during the anti-war protests, when people who didn't know each other came together for a particular cause, a particular reason. We saw this also with, the AIDS protests. People were gathered because of the pain and needed and wanted to do something, and they wanted to do it together. So, and we saw it at the beginning of the Clinton administration after, you know, years of Reagan, Bush, and all these deaths. There was hope on the horizon, and hence major disappointment with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and DOMA, you know, is betrayed by Bubba is kind of the feeling. And then the same thing with Obama. You know, I mean, our first black president, there was a sense of euphoria in that, you know, it felt like the country was finally coming around to, you know, the peace, love, happiness, togetherness, you know, come together, the whole. And then there are these crashes. It's like a crash of a wave onto the rocks of reality. And it's like, wait a second. You know, how could I have been this euphoric? And now these people over here not only want to stop that, but they want to hurt me, and they're succeeding. So then there's a drop in that hope and a subsequent depression. So what I've seen over time is up and down, up and down, up and down, a lot dependent on the environment and, by the way, how different groups react too, and different groups come and go as the leaders speak up or don't speak up or, you know, screw up, you know, and then maybe they're not so reliable as before or disappear or come to the fore. So that's sort of in the professional realm. Suicide has been a constant throughout that, because the other constant throughout that has been these anti-LGBT religious attitudes. So we see a reaction when, you know, say Christian ministers stand up to Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, for instance. Prop 8 saw a lot of that in 2008. But I want to address on a personal. I want to look at this from a personal perspective as well. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, so I suppose I have a form of mental illness. There's something screwy in my brain that makes me addicted to alcohol, drugs, and, you know, frankly, anything else that I get a hankering for. So I have to watch it. In the course of my recovery, I also discovered that, for lack of a better way to put it, I'm also addicted to thoughts of suicide. I'm a suicide survivor several times over. I actually succeeded and then was brought back and then was, you know, I was underage in Connecticut, so I was thrown in a mental institution as a ward of a state, and that's a whole other story. But, you know, I survived. I'm here. I'm healthy. I'm sane. But the thing is that what I had to say sometimes on a daily basis is I will not drink, use, or kill myself 1 minute at a time. So sometimes I wonder, when we talk about what can we do to help people, sometimes it's an individual thing to find out where they're coming from, what their pain is that they want to kill themselves over, as the previous, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, previous person just said, you know, you want to kill yourself when really you want to only kill your pain. You know, it's important to find out what that is and get people to share, to talk about their story and overcome the stigma of talking about that, the shame of talking about that. But the other thing is to understand that there's kind of a resonating PTSD, if you will, about what causes that in the first place, that stigma, that shame, that sense of loneliness, that why do I want to live in a world that is like this? I mean,
right.
Why?
Yep. You know, Karen,
so we need to kind of personalize the resources as well, and I think that may cost a little bit of money and imagination that people might not have.
Right. Also, what you just said, I think, is really very important, not only in finding a cure or help or the right approach to it, but it leads me to a question I wanted to ask for Brody, which is, Brody, the media covers these stories, and, you know, people who, and I know from being a closeted gay kid and everybody else's stories, you know, the media reaches us directly, even though it's very mass audience. And it's kind of gone from the sublime to the ridiculous. On the one hand, many of these cases are glorified, and the person is kind of martyred, and their situation almost enviable, which seems to me to be almost triggering in that regard. And on the other hand, some media is so disrespectful that it could create additional shame for people who are susceptible. What are your comments about media coverage and this situation in general?
Well, I think that this is a two-parter. The first thing is that I definitely would want both Dr. Cheryl and Alan to weigh in on what I'm about to say. In 2010, we had a high incidence of suicide clusters of LGBTQI individuals across the United States. Most of them were adolescents. Part of the problem, I think, is my profession. I think it is the media. I think that we're not doing a very good job of balance, and I think that this has a lot to do with the way that we see things getting spun. Personally, I think that we're not giving balance to what these challenges are, how they're affected, and we're not getting enough exposure to people like Dr. Cheryl and Ellen to get out there and say, okay, this is what we need to do. I think that we're failing in that regard. I think that sometimes that we do, unfortunately, go for, as we used to say when I was in print journalism, you know, putting enough ink out there to sell the papers, as was seen by this case in the Bronx with the young man who killed his tormentors. So, and also with the cases in Missouri, and of course with Scout as well. I think that we need to really say what resources are there, and my question would go back to Dr. Cheryl and to Ellen, to either, and you both can answer this or one can answer this, but I would like to know, what is it you need from those of us in the media that would be the most effective, that would help you get the messaging out there? Because I think a lot of times, particularly with the advent of Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, these being the principal means of communication, particularly for the younger LGBTQI individuals, what is it can I do? What is it can we do? What's the messaging we need to do to create a greater sense of awareness? Because I think the dynamics have changed, as Ellen indicated, from when she and I were young. Go ahead, either one.
Yeah, well, actually, I want to add to that question first, and I want to ask Ellen to answer that. And I want to nuance Brody's question in that different groups within the LGBT community seem to have specific needs, as the rates of suicide are higher for transgender and even higher for bisexual kids. What should be done specifically to people in those groups, and maybe even from our own community as well? And Ellen, why don't you go first and Dr. Sarah?
Yeah. Sure. So, you know, yes, we do have data, and we have more and more data, you know, as the years go that do really, what we knew anecdotally or thought was true anecdotally about, you know, these higher rates of substance use, depression, anxiety, sometimes including suicidal thoughts or suicide attempts among LGBTs. Like, that was a narrative. I'm a social worker, and I've been a social worker for 30 years. And when we, those of us who were like the pioneers who were doing, you know, quote unquote LGBTQ youth work, that was the narrative. Like, LGBTQ are more likely to have this, that, this, you know, this, all these sort of pathologies, if you will. And we have worked really hard to shift the narrative, and I think it's really important to emphasize on the show and in the context of this conversation that the reason the data from as recent as 1 year ago do show that LGB-identified high school students compared to straight-identified high school students, 30% had thought about suicide compared to 5% of the straight kids. They didn't ask gender identity. That's why I'm not intentionally leaving out trans and non-binary kids. It just wasn't part of that particular survey. And we've seen that in many other surveys. And so, you know, if you are not an informed person, you might look at that data and think, well, these are really fucked up kids. Excuse my language. These are really messed up kids, you know. And that is not the narrative. The narrative is, you are born into a world that is still heteronormative, that it still believes in a, you know, a gender binary and rigid gender performance, and where still way too many parents don't accept or affirm or really embrace their queer kids, where schools are still not safe for many kids, where peers reject their LGBTQ peers, and where you've got, you know, hostile language coming from, to, you know, Karen's great point. We've got, you know, hostile language coming from elected officials, from members of the clergy, from people who were supposed to be leaders and role models. And so, you know, it's these are such fragile situations for LGBTQ people. It's not that we're, you know, we're sort of wired to be more depressed or to use drugs or to, I mean, it's the environment, it's the oppression, it's the stigma, it's the, you know, feeling like you're always othered. And, you know, what we see with kids and resilience and the, you know, the kids who do better and don't have as much mental health distress and don't think about or try to commit suicide, they've got layers and layers of support. You know, they've got supportive family. They live in a more kind of progressive or inclusive environment. Their schools are more welcoming and safe. They've got things to look forward to. They've got things going for them, you know. But I think for the LGBT youth who are, you know, those who become the stories that we see, and I will speak to the media question, Brody, which is a great one. You know, it's there's just mental health. I mean, we are, you know, LGBTQ folks have mental health challenges the same as everybody else. And then you can layer onto that, if you're from maybe a more economically challenged community or a community where it's people don't talk about mental health or it's shameful to get therapy or you're supposed to just pick yourself up from the bootstraps. And, you know, if that's your family culture or if you don't have the means to get help, you know, all those things kind of are compounding. I think, you know, what I think could be really helpful, Brody, when we learn about the suicide of an LGBT person, especially a young person, is to just be very thoughtful about how we report, you know, really not talking much about details, and to try to maybe understand what was happening in that person's life. I mean, you know, generally speaking, and I will refer to the, you know, the licensed clinician on the call, but, you know, folks don't just have a bad day and think that's it. I think that what others said about that, the pain, like, you know, it's like you can imagine, you know, most of us fortunately can imagine that if your arm was in so much pain, you can't bear it. You feel like you have to just cut your arm off. It is such an intense crushing pain and often cannot be articulated at all. And so, you know, I think to try to have compassion and understand what's happening contextually for young people, and not to make the story of these suicides about the one person we lost, but to take those opportunities to point to things we're doing well that we need to do more of, and things that we're not doing and need to do, you know, and need to start doing to support young people.
That makes sense.
Excellent point.
Yeah.
Dr. Searle, can you address some of the points that have been brought up, one of which is what things both in the media and in personal life would act as triggers for people who are susceptible, and then also what are signs that people around them should be aware of to show that this is not just balance point, another bad day?
Yeah, I think to speak to the first point about triggers, and it's kind of in the media and in life, there's a great, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a little bit of like a recommendations for media page, and actually gives recommendations for how to write an article similar to what was just explained, about that really not as much about the person, but more about then the stigma of suicide, what to do about it, treatment options, and even giving those warning signs, which I can go into, that's a less triggering media portrayal of what happened. And, you know, I think a lot of people writing, journalists writing, aren't going to go, I don't know, so I'm just speaking, but my guess is aren't looking for those recommendations. They're trying to write the story that's going to get published and so that people will read. And to be able to cover all the points and have the warning signs and have treatment options in the article isn't the first thing on that journalist's mind, it's the story. And I think that is to look at, like I said, on that website, there's kind of like just a short guideline. And that can help, because if it's sensationalized or it's made to seem like the individual had that bad day, you know, or isn't explained well or like to the point as much, then those who are reading it may just assume, had a bad day, oh, I had a bad day, or I've thought about this before. But if they're reading something that says, hey, here are the options if you're feeling this way, here's the number for the suicide prevention hotline, here's the number for, you know, a crisis hotline in your area, whatever it is, it's giving them something to have. And it's the same way that a school, if someone, you know, dies by suicide in a school, to prevent it, I'm at home.
If you hadn't confessed, we would have thought it was Bodie's dog. So you're
right. Well, I'm sorry about that. To prevent contagion effect in schools, they should have people come in and talk about treatment options with everybody, anybody that's in that person's life, and that could be anybody in the school. I could hear about somebody that I don't even know, but if I relate to them on some level, that could be a trigger, you know, not for me really, but for me, if I'm that kid in a small town and I hear about another kid in a small town. So I think always having the options in an article or in any, like, setting would be helpful for that person. And then to talk about the warning signs, like you were saying, any, you know, there's talking about wanting to die. If somebody has been very depressed, honestly, if somebody's been feeling very sad and all of a sudden has a burst of energy, and a lot of times there's an excitement of, oh, that person's finally feeling better. But that's actually sometimes the hardest part, because they actually have the burst of energy to act on their thoughts in those moments. So not always jumping to the conclusion that just because somebody seems better than a day after they seemed very depressed, that that's automatically they're, you know, in a better place. Writing about death, writing about suicide, giving away, you know, warning time, giving away any of your possessions or talking about that, mood swings, showing, you know, any, those kinds of, talking about just not wanting to live, even using those words the first sign that you should, you know, be telling somebody about this, that they should be talking to a therapist or seeing a psychiatrist or being supported by their family. And so often, as people were talking, you know, some of you guys were talking about before, those families aren't supportive, or this world doesn't feel supportive to them. And so always having options available gives them one less step they have to take to look for those options. So it's easier if they're reading an article or looking online and seeing, oh, I can call this number, or, oh, here's a website that will show me people that have felt very similarly. Here are the therapists, you know, how to find therapists in my area. Anything you can do to keep them hooked on what can be helpful and hopeful, rather than make, you know, oh, it seems like so much work to go through all of that, and then they, you know, decide not to.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's incredible. Karen, I wanted to ask you, if, first of all, if you had a follow-up to the doctor.
I do, because
also, before you jump in that, I have a question for you, too, in that you and I go back in the day with recovery, and part of my experience within that time period was a lot of LGBT people coming in and having to deal with the core of the addiction process and then the triggers that we had to deal with. In other words, the core was there and would have been there anyway, but was probably exacerbated by our discrimination experiences. And I wanted to get your comments on that as well, as long as you're up to date.
Okay. Again, a two-part answer then. First of all, regarding writing these stories about suicides, I've talked to Ann Haas about this. I've talked to a number of people about how, you know, as you were just saying, about how to not trigger somebody. But on the other hand, I'm not writing for clicks. I'm not writing to get published. I'm not writing to, you know, for accolades. I'm writing to tell a story and honor the person who just died. That person can either die, you know, be erased in a story that sort of skirts over who they are and how and why they came to this position, what was so dire. And, you know, I feel a certain obligation to the person who died, as well as, frankly, to the family, because oftentimes the family keeps going, you know, well, wait a second, we loved him. You know, what happened? I mean, I talked to the teacher about bullying. Where did I go wrong? As if it was that person's fault that this kid committed suicide. So there, it's really tricky. But, you know, I think that telling this person's story without glorifying, so that too doesn't become a trigger and you don't have contagion, as it were. But, you know, I really think that it is important to honor that person so that their suicide doesn't erase their whole life. And that they wind up being of service in some way, as you were saying, kind of like tagging out with, if you have these feelings, here are people, you know, here's a hotline you can call, here are resources in your area or whatever. But you need to get people to read the story in the first place to even get to the resources. And frankly, you know, to look in the mirror that story holds up. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've cried writing those stories because I see myself. So I think that, you know, that's very important. Secondly, to the addiction thing, I do think that addiction exacerbates, you know, and frankly kicks into gear, you know, an underlying problem, whether it's kind of a loneliness that is so grating and painful and yet ironically so comfortable. And we have a saying in our 12-step programs, don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And if you can catch yourself in having any one of those feelings, pick up the phone and call somebody and spill the beans, you know, confess, share what you're feeling, because, you know, that kind of sharing isn't in and of itself is considered a weakness. I mean, I had to learn how to surrender to tell the truth about myself, and then I found out that wound up being a strength. I had no idea. But, you know, you have to get over the hurdle of a lifetime of your parents and society telling you to buck up and move on. That's what I mean also by the PTSD sticking with you. It's kind of like this, you know, this little tumor of cancer that keeps growing and growing and growing. And what we haven't talked about, because we focused on the kids, is suicide among the LGBT elderly, especially those who in this era may have to go, you know, back in the closet in order to, you know, get into a facility that will take care of them in their later life.
Right.
Then we have to, just as people with AIDS and assisted, the whole assisted suicide movement talks about, is, wait a second, is there a good death? You know, quality of life over a painful quantity. And certainly that's something that, you know, seniors, boomer, baby boomers like myself are looking at. But I think that addiction and fighting addiction every day, that is a mental illness, and you have to be aware of it so you can fight it. If you're not aware of it, then it just eats at you. It's the burr under the saddle that keeps at it all the time.
Absolutely.
And you're not even aware of it.
Right, absolutely. Brody, I wanted to ask you both to follow up on the things we've been talking about, especially from your journalistic perspective, but also another comment from you potentially on one thing that I deal with as an activist, that as soon as I started looking at LGBT kids and their situations, is whether some of our positive stuff that we put out there, the gung-ho that come out, it gets better, a lot of the rhetoric that we put out there that is encouraging them to expect something in their personal situations that might not come to fruition. In other words, they may come out and find the personal people around them are actually very detrimental. Are we accidentally setting some of this up through positivity?
I think that's
sure.
There's part of this, and Ellen is probably going to be the person I'm going to address this to, because she does policy. And I think that as a journalist, looking at it, you know, it's one thing for the coverage point, and I was going to have a follow-up with Dr. Cheryl, but Karen covered it. So, Ellen, let me ask you this. Mental health care is woefully underfunded in America, and as you know, the criminal justice system is probably the only institution now that picks up the slack. In 2014, a national survey by the Treatment Advocacy Center concluded, and I'm quoting, not only are the numbers of mentally ill in prisons and jails continuing to climb, the severity of the inmates' illnesses is on the rise as well. The survey also found that people with serious mental illnesses are going to find themselves in prisons and jails, outnumbering those in state hospitals on a 10-to-1 ratio. Now, while it's widely pretty much agreed that this setup isn't ideal, this is the reality of the existence, which is, it's causing some law enforcement officials to change their ways at the urging of people like you and Dr. Cheryl, and that is to some extent, you know, on the harm reduction ratio. But I think that we've got two fundamental problems here, and I think that as a member of the media, this is probably also incumbent on me to talk about, and that is that police officers in the United States, law enforcement of any kind, may not necessarily understand that the people that are going through their psychotic episodes generally aren't in control of their actions at the time. So if this is the case, do we need to focus more on policy? Is it more, as a journalist, I need to talk about policy? And since you're at the Human Rights Campaign, you're probably most eminently qualified to answer that. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not quite the policy expert that many of my colleagues are. I do kind of like bridge between our public education work and our policy work. But I can say, having done a lot of direct service work, mostly, you know, supporting people with HIV, many of whom interfaced with mental health systems or behavioral health systems. We have a woefully inadequate system of care for people with mental illness, and I mean all types of mental illness, from what would be, you know, a very kind of high-functioning person with depression that needs support to maintain that high-functioning, to folks who are having, you know, acute, you know, kinds of experiences like perhaps Scout was having at Georgia Tech, and you know, the whole range of experiences people have. We had for years massive institutionalization of people who, you know, had more severe mental health diagnoses, and then we had a major defunding of all that, and many people with pretty serious mental illness were, you know, thrown out to the streets and, you know, are essentially, you know, in and out of emergency rooms and very prevalent among the homeless population. And so what happens then is people with mental illness, particularly those who are homeless or, you know, transient, are, you know, they're constantly criminalized. And so they're arrested for, you know, a certain kind of behavior, and then they're in jail. And what they really need is, you know, mental health treatment. But we have never really prioritized, you know, I think because mental health, people who don't have good mental health have endured so much stigma, and, you know, there's just not, you know, we haven't built in, I mean, ideally we would have, you know, much better mental health coverage, much better access to mental health services if you're not insured or uninsured or in a poorer community or rural community. And then add to that for the LGBT community, you know, even where there might be some services available, meaning like you can find a clinic or a provider, they're not necessarily going to be, you know, trans competent or LGB competent or affirming in any way around anybody who's LGBTQ. So I know a lot of folks that I've worked with and spoken to, including my own experience years ago, is you just don't put your toe in that water. You don't reach out for help. You don't ask for help if you have that added worry that because of your sexual orientation or gender identity, you're not going to get what you need. You're not going to be treated with respect or dignity. And that, in fact, somebody might try to make this all about your gayness or queerness or transness instead of seeing you as someone who is walking in the door with in distress or with anxiety or with with sadness or whatever your experience is. So, and I feel like there are definitely some policy solutions in terms of what's covered by health insurance and having really all kinds of layers and steps of care from, you know, outpatient weekly therapy that many of us are familiar with and recovery support to, you know, more intensive, you know, daily support, treatment, more in-depth treatment, to the much more higher level, more intensive, very carefully managed care for people with more serious mental health challenges. So those are a couple of thoughts. And I did just want to quickly jump back to the point about media coverage. And there are some very good publications and guidelines about covering stories about suicide and how to use language that's more appropriate language, the fear of contagion, which we talked a little bit in terms of triggers.
Right.
And I love what Karen said about just honoring the person whose life was lost and telling that story, but, you know, avoiding sensationalism, never using any details about in what way they took their life, never making any assumptions about what the trigger was, because, you know, again, it's often really compounding experiences and compounding factors. Never make assumptions that the parents weren't supportive or that someone's to blame. So, you know, I think there are some good guidelines out there for all of us to look at. And, finally, Brody, you know, anything we can do to shine the light on the lack of, you know, comprehensive and competent mental health services and to, you know, to get people to pay more attention to that. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's so much you could like we're overwhelmed with news right now, and many of us are just hoping we survive this current administration. But in terms of just putting a spotlight on these ongoing, you know, social challenges, health challenges, I think that would be very important for the community.
Okay, that's fair enough, and I appreciate I guess the only thing that I would follow up with, because you just broached that, is do you think that given the current political environment and the reemergence of the family values and Christian groups that, you know, were more or less kind of powered down during the last administration, do you see as what happened to Stout and these other individuals becoming more of an acute problem?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think everyone kind of spoke to that in different ways, and Karen was incredibly eloquent about that. It's, you know, we are, you know, just as young, and I think you mentioned something like the whole idea of it gets better. First of all, young people who have clinical depression or who are dealing with chronic mental health challenges, if hearing that it gets better and just hang in there, live openly and freely, if you cannot do that mm-hmm. because you don't have the internal resources or you don't have the external support, in some way those messages can actually make you feel like there is something very wrong about you. So I think we do have to be careful how we nuance those messages. I mean, we hope that things get better for all of us in whatever way that means for us. But I think that for young queer people who are really struggling, that it gets better message is like just a lot of BS when they're in their pain. So that doesn't work for everybody, you know? And I think that you asked me that. I was going to get back to your other question, and I kind of forgot what it was. Do you mind just prompting me very quickly, and I'll briefly answer?
I'm good. Your answer actually framed it. I think we probably have a couple of questions for Dr. Cheryl now, but I appreciate your perspective on that, because one of the things that I have difficulty with as a journalist is framing the context of it. And the It's Get Better campaign was very difficult to frame that context. So I thank you for your answer. And I'll throw it back to Rob for Cheryl.
Cheryl, what was your take on that?
On the It Gets Better piece?
Yeah, what you exactly. You're the therapist.
Coming after that.
Well, you know, and I may have a little bit of bias if I think about my own patients being in New York and Brooklyn, where the environment that I'm in tends to be a little bit more open and liberal, and those things can be helpful. But I agree that, you know, for the kid that's in a small town that hears that, that is just, you know, getting excited and saying, okay, it can get better, and they attempt it and they come out and it doesn't go well, it can be really harmful for that person, and especially if there's no other resources in place for them. And I think at the same time, those messages of hope can't go away either, because without them, there's so many youth that won't have that. And with so many youth that, while I guess what I'm trying to, I think it needs to be a more comprehensive message and be more individualized, and it can get better for people. And I think at the same time, that also, if it doesn't get better, there has to be a message that, yeah, it can get better and it might not, you know, and it's not going to be better tomorrow for you necessarily. But I'm also, you know, the way I practice, and I'm a firm believer that when someone is able to come out and live their authentic lives and be their authentic selves, they are able to live a fulfilling life. But at the same time, I think I'm talking again to the people who are in New York City and in Brooklyn and who aren't necessarily experiencing the same thing and the same type of stressors and whatnot that other people might be facing, and they don't and might not have the same resources. You know, I'm seeing people who are also seeing who are coming in for therapy. There are people who aren't doing that, and those are the people who need it the most. If they hear this, it gets better. But I also, I can't discourage it at the same time, because it really has saved so many lives. And there's even a like top hit right now by a rapper, and the title of it is the Suicide Prevention Hotline, and it, that's what it's about. And he performed it at the, I think, MTV VMAs, and the number of calls skyrocketed. Now, I don't know what happened after those calls, but that fact is it's getting out there to the youth, and that's, you know, it needs to be out there. It just needs to be more comprehensive, and it needs to be more detailed for those kids who are hearing it, and it actually doesn't get better for them the next day or week or month.
Right. No, it's excellent, excellent points all the way around. We've got only about 4 minutes left. I wanted to ask both Ellen and Dr. Cheryl. You know, we've been a little bit hard on our friends here, Karen and Brody, and media and coverage and all that stuff. What about the other side of it in terms of what comes out of both our advocacy groups and our sort of influence on media and dramatization, et cetera? It seems like the stigma of mental health is pushed under the cover, and we want to present gay people in the most positive light, and we never, I can't think of any depiction in the entertainment media that really shows a full-fledged LGBT person grappling with these, especially related to their either sexual orientation or gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some comment on that?
Yeah, and this is Ellen. I think that's a great question and a great point. I think about sort of the fact that, you know, being quote-unquote homosexual was, you know, a diagnostic, it was a diagnosed mental illness for years in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible for mental health providers. And, you know, we were pathologized for, you know, decades and decades, and, you know, called sick and twisted and ill and locked up and given, you know, electric shock therapy and sent to conversion therapy. And, you know, really, you know, when you think about the incredible progress we've made, although obviously lots further to go, to get to the place where, you know, we have marriage equality and we have protections in so many major corporations and we have elected, you know, out elected officials and out elected actors and, you know, all the, it's like, you know, it is sort of day and night from where we started. And so I think there's probably a lot of fear about kind of drawing back the curtain and saying, look, you know, some of us are alcoholics, some of us have depression, some of us have PTSD, some of us are, you know, schizophrenic. I think there's a lot of risk and there's a lot of vulnerability in that, because there's been such, you know, such hard work by so many of us for so many years to say we're just like everybody else. And now if we could take that truth that we are just like everybody else, meaning that just like everybody else, some of us are going to struggle with mental illness. Some of us are going to be parents. Some of us aren't. Some of us are going to, you know, it should be, but you know, you have to like chisel away at the stigma. And one of the things I'm really proud of is we just started a new partnership with Mental Health America, and together we're sort of building a message campaign featuring out LGBTQ people, including many young people, making short videos talking, saying, "Hey, my name is Zachary. I'm, you know, a gay man, and I live with depression, and I've tried to take my life several times, and every day can feel like a struggle for me. And here's what's helping me, and here's why it's important to talk about it, you know, and to really push through that stigma. So I think that's really essential. But keeping in mind how vulnerable we are.
Yeah, I've got to interrupt, unfortunately, because we are down to literally seconds. So I want to thank you both, Dr. Cheryl, actually all four of you, Dr. Cheryl, Ellen, for coming on and joining us tonight for this super important discussion. I think we need to lift the stigma, and I think we've done some of that tonight, and I hope this is passed around and people hear this. Brody and Karen, thank you both, as always, for being on board. Your insights and questions and expertise is completely invaluable. To our audience, thank you for listening. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio on Thursday nights.
also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com, 7 p.m. Saturday evening. We have an exciting conversation with Major Whip and her new book about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Look forward to having you then. Good night.
Thank you.